It was a cold Thanksgiving weekend in 2008 when the food truck Kogi Barbecue was launched in Los Angeles. Now, behind its wheel was rebel chef Roy Choi, trained in fine dining, but restless to feed the city that he loved with a more democratic approach. His Korean tacos were priced at $2 apiece. In a few months, that truck became the icon of the L.A. street scene. He went on to pick up Food & Wine's Best Chef Award in 2010 and has written a memoir, L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. Jennifer A. Lee met up with him in his hometown, Los Angeles.
Hey, Roy, thanks for joining us from L.A.
Good to be here.
I want to say that I love Korean food, and I grew up, you know, Chinese-American in New York City, and my family ate Korean food for Thanksgiving because that was our special meal. And I always couldn't understand why it took so long to break into the mainstream. And so I was wondering, like, why you think you were able to do that, and, you know, whether or not, you know, the mix with Korean tacos was the way that Korean food had to break in. Because your parents ran a Korean restaurant, but at that time it was mostly Korean clientele, correct?
Yeah, correct. And, you know, it's weird because the Kogi taco really never represented Korean food. It represented L.A., but through that gateway, somehow it came back to Korea. As far as why Korean food maybe took a while, I think the two parts are, one, maybe Koreans didn't want it to blow up, you know, on the real. You know, we're a hermit culture. We're kind of private in what we do. And we really didn't care whether you, you know, whether mainstream liked our food or not. You know, most of the menus were written in Korean. None of them were written in English. You know, so it really didn't register in our brains, in our family brains. The other part is, a Korean meal is not a linear meal. It's not like you start at one point and you end at the other. And so the Western way of eating is always appetizer, starter, salad, or whatever, and then main course and then dessert. So you start at A and you end at Z. Korean meal comes from all points at the same time, and it's not on one plate. So I think it was very hard to try to, like, take all of that and put it into a linear form. And then so maybe the streets helped that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and what I always thought was interesting about Korean cuisine was, unlike Chinese food and parts of Japanese food, which really kind of catered to the American palate, Korean food, like, held its ground. And it was, like you said, what it was meant to be. So it's interesting to see how much a phenomenon Korean tacos have become, not just, you know, in L.A. where you started, but across the country. Why do you think it caught fire, like, so quickly?
I mean, the food part is because I believe it was delicious, you know.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, nobody can hate on a taco, you know. So that right there was already a vessel that made people look and care and take a chance. That's one on the food level. On the other level, we combine Twitter with food. So it was the first time kind of food had a voice, a viral voice. And we had a personality behind it. We were out there. We had the same fundamental principles as any chef-driven kitchen, you know, but our attitude and our demeanor and our voice was different. But then when you looked beyond the technology and the voice, you saw organization, cleanliness. You saw hard work ethics and honesty in food. And so I think all of that together created a groundswell, for sure. And then the fact that we were mobile, you know, that we could go out to people, and the voice was young. So we hit a whole new generation, made a bridge for people to connect with food.
So, Roy, before you actually started the Korean barbecue truck, your entire background is a mix of highs and lows. Tell me a little bit about all the lines that brought you to Kogi.
It's crazy because the first wave of Korean immigrants, the large wave, there were many that came through Hawaii and some parts of the mainland way before in the early 1900s, but the main wave came in late 60s and early 70s. And that for that first wave, most of them were educated, and but they came, and if you weren't studying science, you ended up, even if you had a PhD in history, nobody was giving you a job. You couldn't get a job. So long story short, we became merchants. And so you had all these educated people ended up owning liquor stores, gas stations, dry cleaners, all that stuff. My parents were the same, came in, opened a liquor store in K-Town, and then our life kind of built from there. You know what I mean? Their whole dream was just to continue to thrive and move up. many different businesses, from liquor stores to restaurants to jewelry stores. Some failed, some succeeded, and all they cared about was their children.
And how do you think that shaped your sort of culinary path?
Oh, it shaped everything because, you know, food was always there. They always seemed to find the money or the time to have great food on the table. And then growing up in a restaurant from like third to seventh grade was a big deal. It was crazy because it was like being in, you know, just an environment that's just alive all the time, you know.
And your mom made great kimchi that was drew a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, before the restaurant, you know, going back to the immigration, it was about the hustle. You know, any immigrant that comes to this country has their own story of hustle, because in most cases, you come here with no money in your pocket. You know what I'm saying? So, like, it don't matter who you were. It matters on who you become. So my mom was cooking all the time, and she was packing kimchis and pangchans and dried fish and all these things. And then we put them in cardboard boxes, put them in the trunk, and she would just go literally door to door and sell them, you know, like try to find all the Korean families. And then, you know, a reputation built from the, or if there were parties, she would bring all the food, you know. My mom's kind of gangster like that. She doesn't ask permission, you know what I mean? So, like, she'll show up at the party, you know, with a trunk load of food. And, like, she wasn't supposed to show up with a trunk load of food, you know what I mean? That, you got to feel me on that. And so then she'll show up, and the party's going on, and then she'll pull out all this kimchi. And it becomes like an Amway sale, but it's kimchi instead, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, that definitely built her rep. And then it led to a restaurant.
And how do your parents feel about all your success since then?
I mean, I'm sure they're very proud and happy, and I'm happy and proud for them. But they're still needling me as parents, you know. Why don't you do this? Why aren't you in New York? Why aren't you on that? If I'm on Time, why aren't you on CNN? If you're on CNN, why aren't you on this? If you're on public radio,
they're
why
aren't very
you?
Asian parents,
yeah, why aren't you on that? You know, yeah. So at some point, I had to like, you know, just be at peace with all that.
Yeah. Hey, Roy. Thanks a lot for speaking with us today, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Thank you. It's a new day.
Roy Choi is author of L.A. Sun: My Life, My City, My Food. Jennifer Eight-Lee is the publisher of Daily Lit and the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Now, Roy left us with a recipe for beef cheek tacos with salsa verde, as well as a cooler recipe, cardamom milk shave ice. Find them at splendidtable.org.